Man, I timed that perfect. Like the storm is coming, right? Open up your Bibles or devices to Exodus chapter 21. We're actually going to skip over the Ten Commandments for a little bit of time. We'll have more to say about that in just a few minutes. I am just struck as we were singing, Come Behold the Wondrous Mystery, just really overcome this morning with the idea that God in eternity past, before anything was ever created and only God himself existed, looked out into the future, into eternity, saw a sinner like me and made a decision to come and die, to redeem and save and forgive wretched, rotten human beings of which I may be the worst. And friends, that has nothing to do with my sermon this morning and yet everything to do with every sermon I have ever preached and hope that I will ever preach. But this morning we're going to talk a lot more about the transforming mark of our Master. In 2013, we just celebrated July the 4th, Independence Day, and in 2013, at the time, Christian rapper Lecrae, he tweeted a picture, I think we have it, on July the 4th. I think we have that picture for you guys, and it was a picture of slaves picking cotton, and it had a caption that read, What My Ancestors Were Doing, or My Family, on July the 4th, 1776. Now, that stings. It hurts a little bit. But it's good because it forces us as white Americans and maybe even as white Christians in particular to think about the fact that maybe July 4th, 1776 is maybe not Independence Day for every single person in our country. America is the land of the free. We are a symbol of liberty and freedom all around the world. And yet even in our country, perhaps the freest in the history of the planet, we are reminded that not everyone has always been free, or certainly not as free as others. So today we're going to tackle a passage that deals a lot with the issue of slavery, how to interact with those slaves, and really, in particular, the right way to set those slaves free. That is a sensitive topic. I have to treat this subject very fairly, and I may have to go into more detail than maybe a pastor in a predominantly or only white church would have to go into. It's a pleasure and a privilege to have a church family that is diverse, that has to wrestle with these kinds of things. And so I hope that you will not ignore me because you are worried about what is going to be the subject matter. You're worried about maybe what the person next to you is thinking or something of that nature. So I hope by the end of the day, though, my main hope is not just to wrestle with those issues together with you, with the Word of God, but I hope by the end of the day to show you that African Americans in our country are not unique, and that they potentially celebrate Independence Day on a date different from everyone else. Because you see, everybody here who has trusted Jesus Christ as their Savior has a different date upon which they celebrate Independence Day, the day that Jesus set them free from the things that they were chained to. So if you guys do have your devices, go ahead and or Bibles, go ahead and open them up to Exodus chapter 21. I do want to take just a moment as we talk about the transforming marks of our Master. I do want to take just a moment to talk about really this kind of mini-series within this sort of greater series in the book of Exodus. We are skipping Exodus 19 and 20 now. Those are for reasons that are really not important to share today. We'll get to that. We're going to go back through those. Trust me, that's just a matter of time. But today we're going to start a new mini-series through Exodus 21 through 23. Now, if you were to sit down and read all of these verses, like separate of a sermon, really probably the modern reader, if they had to pick three words to describe Exodus 21 through 23, they would be this: boring, tedious, and mundane. And then probably we would say boring again, even though that's a fourth word, just for good measure. Now, friends, I'll go ahead and be honest with you. They are tedious and mundane because it's legal code, right? You ever went to a law library and read the law books? It is tedious and it is mundane. But, friends, it is not boring. These rules or this legal code is about how to live for the glory of God in real life, right? How to put the gospel into practice, into the everyday things of life. And friends, we need that kind of instruction because I am convinced more than ever that we are a group of people who know how to glorify God at church, but have no idea how to do that in the common things of life. As an example of that, 1 Corinthians 10:31 says, whether you eat or drink, do all things to the glory of God. John Piper comments on that because of what that verse says, it means that we should drink orange juice to the glory of God. And I say that to all of you, and the idea of that seems crazy and absurd because we have no idea how to do the common everyday things like drink orange juice to the glory of God. So I have chosen to entitle this little mini-series, if you will, Common Gospel, for that reason. And so we're going to examine over the next several set of texts what it looks like to not just hear the gospel at church, but see the gospel put into practice in everyday life. So what I want to do today is just kind of read the text in sections. And so we're just going to read verse 1 of Exodus 21, and then we'll kind of come back and read the rest of the text later. So read with me Exodus chapter 21, verse 1. Now these are the rules. This is God speaking to Moses. These are the rules that you shall set before them. So now let's talk for a few moments about the role of these rules, if you will, Exodus 21 through 23 in ancient Israel and the modern church. Exodus 21 through 23 are known as the Book of the Covenant, right? And so a question that we need to answer first is this: how important are these rules that we find in Exodus 21 through 23? How important are these rules for modern day believers, right? Is this just for ancient Israel, or do they have any bearing on my life right here where I am at today? And so these rules, first of all, we need to note that they form the legal code of Israel. And what some critics will do is they will point out the resemblance between Israel's legal code and the legal code of the nations around them at the time. And they will say, well, that's just proof that they didn't get these from God, right? They'll say they didn't write down what they heard from God. They just copied what they saw in the nations around them. But it should not surprise us when we find commonality between Israel's legal code and the other ancient nations around them. These commonalities don't prove that Israel copied the nations around them, but rather they prove the existence of God. Right? This is Paul's argument in Romans chapter 2, that our sense of justice, our sense of what is right and what is wrong, it is born out of being made in the image of God. Right? Our sense of right and wrong and what is just, friends, those are not based solely upon social constructs, right? What we learn from our parents and the environment around us, there is something instinctive and intrinsic to us as human beings that says this is right and this is wrong. That is born out of being made in the image of God. And since all human beings, regardless of their relationship to God, bear the image of God, it only makes sense then that all cultures at all times in history would have some resemblance to one another in what they decide is right and what is wrong. This is Paul's argument in Romans 2, that people, even people who don't have the law of God, prove that they know the law of God by the legal codes that they write and pass. Paul's argument in Romans 2 is that all of mankind's laws, are not from his imagination, but rather from inspiration, inspired from the divine image of God from within him. And so these rules in Exodus 21 are not from Israel's imagination. They are given from God. And friends, because they are from God, the first thing we need to note is that because they are from God, they are still authoritative. Because they are from God, they are still authoritative. They should be consulted and considered. But that does not mean, because they are authoritative, but that does not mean that they are as authoritative as God's commandments. For instance, the Ten Commandments given just a few verses earlier. So let me say it this way. The rules are not as authoritative as commands. I love the twist, the play on words here in Exodus 21:1. These are not commandments, these are rules. Did you notice the little turn of phrase there? That's sort of saying something to us that while they are authoritative, they are not quite as authoritative as they were as the Ten Commandments. And while they are from God, I do need to note that they apply only in their most literal sense to ancient Israel. So we need to note this. The Ten Commandments are given by God to Moses. God writes them down with his very finger on stone tablets. But if you'll notice, when you read all the way through Exodus 21 through 23, what you notice is that these rules are given by God to Moses, but they're written by Moses with a pen on a piece of paper, right? A piece of paper can more easily be torn apart than stone commandments written with the very finger of God. That tells us or symbolizes for us that while they are authoritative, they are not on the same level with the Ten Commandments. Now, at this point, I do want to take just a moment and explain to you, and I think this will be very helpful to you, that there are four different types of law in the Old Testament. And while all are authoritative, with the exception of the Ten Commandments, what we will call God's moral absolutes, they are all only authoritative to a certain degree. So let's talk about the four types of Old Testament law really, really briefly. The first we want to note is God's moral absolutes. These apply to all people living at all places at all times in history. And it is the breaking of God's moral absolutes for which a person must answer to God. And it is the breaking of these absolutes for which Jesus died. And while the Ten Commandments are not the total sum of God's moral absolutes, they are or do form at least a huge chunk of it, right? The second type of Old Testament law is Israel's military law. And so now we're going to talk about, in each of these you'll notice we're talking about who they apply to. Well, who does Israel's military law apply to? Well, it only applied to ancient Israel in the advent of a battle against an enemy. That means these don't apply to us today at all. Now, there are principles and behind these laws that can still be helpful. But if we're going to try and carry out the specifics of these laws, friends, that's just unnecessary since, number one, we are not ancient Israel, and since we are not in hand-to-hand combat trying to take possession of a land that God promised our ancestors. Right? That's not us. So this doesn't apply to us. Next is Israel's religious law. These laws govern the worship practices of ancient Israel and would even govern really what we would call most of modern Judaism. Included, for instance, in these laws would be the prescriptions for what sacrifice to offer if you committed a certain sin. Because we are not Jews, but rather are followers of Jesus, our perfect sacrifice, these laws, while still helpful, man, they're still so helpful because they help us see kind of the foreshadowings of the gospel in the Old Testament. They bring a fullness to the picture of the gospel that we wouldn't know if we didn't have these rules, right? They are not obligatory upon us as 21st century Christians. And lastly, is Israel's national law. Israel is a theophany, which means that their religious law was also their national law, right? They were governed by their religious law. And so these laws offer commentary on how to put the Ten Commandments into practical use in the nuances of everyday life. And while these laws are authoritative, they are also not exhaustive. They cannot cover every possible scenario that might arise. And much of what we read in Exodus 21 through 23, the book of the covenant, is in this last category of national law. These were obligatory upon the nation of Israel in the Old Testament. And while they are not obligatory upon us, they should still be observed when possible today, right? When possible today. A struggle with these rules that we're going to find, for instance, again in the book of the covenant, is that applying them to the letter of the law is almost impossible because they often comment on things that are contextually not applicable to our modern setting, right? So they're going to have words and instructions about arranged marriages and slavery and things of that nature, things that are not applicable to our modern world. So friends, where they are still able to be applied, we should apply them. Where they can no longer be applied, because the specifics of the law speak to a different contextual difference, we should still look for and apply the spirit of the law, right? There's a principle behind the law that we can still apply into our lives, even if we can't apply that law very literally and specifically into our lives. And one of those contextual differences between the world of Exodus and our world is human slavery. And because that is a term so emotionally charged, given our American history with it, we need to examine the differences between American or what we would call antebellum Southern slavery and Hebrew slavery in the book of Exodus. So read with me Exodus chapter 21, verses 2 through 6, and then we'll spend some time talking about the role of slavery in ancient Israel. When you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve 6 years, and in the seventh he shall go out free for nothing. If he comes in single, he shall go out single. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master gives him a wife and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's and he shall go out alone. But if the slave plainly says, I love my master, my wife and my children, I will not go out free, then his master shall bring him to God and he shall bring him to the door of the doorpost and his master shall bore his ear through with an awl and he shall be his slave forever. And so now let's talk about the role of slavery in ancient Israel compared to the role of slavery in the antebellum South. Really, I want to contrast the two using these verses. The first I want to note is this, that American slavery was forced while Hebrew slavery was voluntary. We see this in Exodus chapter 21, verse 16. If we were to skip down, it says this, whoever steals a man and sells him and anyone found in possession of him shall be put to death, meaning that you could not kidnap someone or force them to be a slave against their will, right? If you did, you were put to death. So the first thing we need to note is that this is ancient Hebrew slavery was voluntary. People were volunteering for this, not being forced into it against their will. We also need to address that the term slave is probably not really the best term to use when describing what is happening in ancient Israel for us as Americans, kind of given our history with the term. Slaves were really more servants. There were men and women, but mostly men, who were seeking to pay off debts. That's usually the case. They're broke and cannot pay their bills, and so they need a way to do that. So they show up on the doorstep of a man who was more wealthy and privileged than themselves and say, would you help me? Would you help me get on my feet? And in return for my services, would you give me room and board and teach me a skill? As often what would happen is this would also sort of serve really as an apprenticeship. A man would seek to better himself by learning a skill, something he could use to earn a living doing after he left the master's home. Friends, the reality of debt and poverty in the world created the need or a system where those with insurmountable debts could pay those debts off and then not ruin them for life. Have you ever known someone who is under such a crushing amount of debt that they might get it paid off before they die, but it ultimately was going to cripple them for the rest of their lives trying to get out from underneath it, right? This is what this system of slavery in the Hebrew world was meant to address. Some of these men who are volunteering for slavery would have been the modern equivalent of petty criminals. And their slavery was more like rehabilitation and job training designed to set them up for success when their terms of service to their master ended. In that way, Hebrew slavery is redemptive. It's redemptive. It is helping those who might otherwise wind up in prison for stealing or be huge drains on the economy as they lived in shelters or off government assistance for the rest of their lives. It's helping them learn how to earn a living. Best of all, it did all of this in a way where it gave a man dignity and a sense of worth rather than stealing that sense of value and dignity like American slavery did. And friends, we could even add to that, or like our American instinct towards paternalism and handouts with the poor does. Friends, even though our hearts are often in the right place, we often hurt the poor as we try to help them. We do for them rather than provide opportunities for them to be able to do for themselves, which is what Hebrew slavery did. It gave a man dignity and it let him earn his own living. We unintentionally often rob the poor of their dignity because we do everything for them out of pity rather than provide opportunities for them to be able to provide for themselves out of a deep sense of mercy. And if you have never read it, I highly recommend the book When Helping Hurts, and I'll leave it at that. Hebrew slavery was redemptive because it helped people stay out of jail. It helped them stay off of the streets, and it helped them get on their feet and become independent rather than keeping them dependent upon handouts for the rest of their lives. Next, we can note that American slavery was about the benefit of the master, while Hebrew slavery was about what was mutually beneficial. In Hebrew slavery, the master got work done that needed to be done, but also the slave would learn life and job skills that he could use when his contract was up. He was then, by the way, sent out, I don't know if you caught this, with enough resources to have a chance to be successful in his new life as a free person. The goal of Hebrew slavery, never forget this, the goal of Hebrew slavery was to see the person who was set free never wind up back in servanthood again. If they were sent away from the master empty-handed, what were the chances that they would be right back on the master's doorstep in a few months with their hat in their hands, needing to come back to him to serve him again? It would be quite high, right? So compare the Hebrew intent to help freed slaves have a chance to be successful once they left their masters with the failure of the American government to live up to its promise of 40 acres and a mule for every free man in the Reconstruction era at the conclusion of the Civil War. They promised them that, and then they failed on that promise. America may have set the slaves free, but how are these newly freed people supposed to purchase shelter and feed themselves? Yes, they were free, but they were broke. It was like they were finally allowed to play Monopoly with everybody else, but those who controlled the game refused to give them a bankroll to get started playing. How long would you last? How long would you last in a game of Monopoly if they refused to bankroll you and get you started? When the government set the black man in the South free, it simply patted him on the back and said, good luck, And in doing so, they created a situation where these former slaves only wound up back on the doorsteps of their former owners looking for work and a place to stay, creating a hellacious, legalized form of slavery known as sharecropping. Israel had to do better than that. They had to do better than we did. The purpose of Hebrew slavery was not to keep people in slavery, but to help people get on their feet once they left slavery. And so it sent them out with a bankroll to start a new life. American slavery was permanent. This is our next way it was different. American slavery was permanent while Hebrew slavery was temporary. The principle of Sabbath, it extended to master-slave relationships. Slaves were to work for 6 years and then were free to rest from working for their master by leaving him in the seventh or sabbatical year. Contrast that with American slavery, which was really a life sentence with no hope of parole unless you could, by some miracle, escape, which was rarely successful. The goal of American slavery was to squeeze every dollar out of your flesh that they could, and when you died, they threw you in a shallow grave and promoted the next poor soul who was ready to take your place. Hebrew slaves entered their servitude knowing there was an exact expiration date on that slavery. Hebrew slavery was not meant to be forever, not meant to be a till death do us part kind of thing. It had a finite period and then it was over. That was nothing like American slavery. Next, we can say that American slavery caused a civil war, while Hebrew slavery was just simply civil. Slaves in the American South were coerced to do their work by violence, or at least threat of violence. They refused to cooperate. The miniseries Roots and the scene with Kuta Kinte on the whipping post has burned upon the American conscience forever, the idea of what happened there at a whipping post. Just a few verses down again in Exodus 21, we're going to read that a master was forbidden from mistreating those living in their homes as slaves. Slaves were to be treated civilly, like a member of your home. That was not the case with American slavery, where beating and berating slaves was just the way business got done. Next, we can note that American slavery separated families, while Hebrew slavery protected the sanctity of the family. I cannot imagine the horrors that Southern slavery inflicted upon the families of slaves who lived in the South as it ripped children from their parents' arms. It tore husbands and wives away from their nuclear families. The slave owners felt no responsibility to protect the institution of the family amongst their slaves. They were motivated by simple greed. All that mattered was if they could profit off what they saw as their property. I want you to think of the way a dog owner who has a dog who has a litter of purebred puppies, when they look at the mother and the puppies, they don't see familiar relationships. What do they see? They see the fattening of their bottom line, how they can profit off of these purebred puppies. If you think about that, you may begin to get a small glimpse of the way these slave owners saw their slaves and how they could be so cold for the sake of enriching themselves. Hebrew slavery was meant, though, to be a means of keeping families together. This was the purpose of it. How could the family stay together if dad wound up on the streets? How could the family stay together if dad wound up in jail? How could the family stay together if dad couldn't afford to pay the bills? Right? Hebrew slavery was meant to keep families together, not tear them apart. We see that in a couple of ways in our text. If a man was married when he volunteered for slavery, his wife came with him. But if he was married when he came into slavery, she continued to be the possession, if you will, of her husband, not the owner. She may have chosen to become a slave as well, along with her husband. But even then, in a very real sense, she still belonged to her husband. Once her terms of service were over, she went back to him. And they could not be split up. The master could not split them up. And by inference, we can gather that this would apply to any children in their home as well. In verse 4, we read that if a man was single when he became a slave and then he married one of the other master's slaves while under contract and his time for release came, if she had years, if the new woman he had married, if she had years to left to work on her deal with the master, she had to stay and finish off her debt to the master. And that leads to a pretty simple question. Well, Kevin, how does that sort of protect the sanctity of marriage and the family? Well, first we need to note that as unfair as this maybe initially seems, she had a debt to pay off. The master had likely paid off her debt to someone else. He had purchased her debt. Or maybe she owed him money and he chose to forgive the debt in return for 6 years of labor. So once the debt was paid off and her contract ended, she was free to go and join her husband. Right? This was just what was contractually, legally right. Secondly, her husband did have a few options. He didn't have to leave her behind. He had options that would allow for them to either stay together or maybe be reunited quickly after he left. He could leave and get a job and save his money and purchase her or redeem her. He could pay off the debt that she owed to the master and purchase her freedom, which would have only meant a very short separation. Or he could choose to stay with the master and thus stay with his wife. And while this would mean a lifetime of serving the master, it would also mean not one second apart from his bride. Now, admittedly, these options are not ideal. These options are not ideal. But the situation they're being written to address, that situation is not ideal either. And we need to avoid two major errors as we read the Word of God, especially as we read situations, things that are addressing situations like this. The first thing we need to do is we cannot idealize the Old Testament. We can't. God is aware that the world is broken. And friends, he's aware that it needs not only to be transformed by the power of Jesus Christ, but until Christ returns, it needs to have the evils within it kept at bay and restrained, right? Rules for slavery reflect not that God is pro-slavery or that he is some sort of plantation apologist, but rather that God is aware that the world is corrupted by sin. And in a world corrupted by sin, people will be broken, right? And to prevent those people from being taken advantage of, God sets up rules to govern the institution of things like slavery. Rules like these are not written to continue the utopia peace of a perfect world, but rather to keep at bay the evils of a broken world. I hope that makes sense. Second error we must avoid is, the first area is we can't idealize the Old Testament. The second error we must avoid is reading our cultural ideals back into the Old Testament. Right? This sounds crazy to us, though we ain't even gotten to arranged marriages and fathers selling their daughters yet. We're fixing to get there, right? And we just cannot conceptualize what is going on here because our cultural ideals would never allow it. In addition to that, we have developed things like unemployment, bank loans, welfare, all sorts of things to help people who are in the kinds of situations who are being addressed in this text. But without any of that, and in a strictly agrarian society, and in a culture that said this was the acceptable way to handle a situation like this, what we read into these passages is just not nearly as dark and deplorable as we see it to be when we read it through a 21st century sort of Western set of lenses. Does that make sense? So we can't idealize the Old Testament. Some of the things written there are meant to restrain evil. They're not telling us how things ought to be, but they're telling us how things must be until Christ returns, right? To set all things right. The second thing we can't do is impose our cultural ideals onto the world of the Old Testament and then be surprised when we're shocked by what we see. Now, the first six verses, they deal with males in slavery. That's where we have kind of hung out. The last five verses are going to deal with maidens, we'll say, in slavery for the sake of alliteration. So let's read Exodus 21, verses 7 through 11. When a man sells his daughter as a slave, she shall not go out as the male slaves do. If she does not please her master who has designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people, since he has broken faith with her. If he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her as with a daughter. If he takes another wife to himself, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, or her marital rights. And if he does not do these three things for her, she shall go out for nothing without payment of money. That sounds like crazy stuff. So let's now talk about the role of these rules in protecting and preventing the exploitation of women. Verse 7 describes what would be sort of a disturbing scenario for us. It's a situation we cannot fathom, because we cannot fathom, as Americans, the concept of an arranged marriage. That's what's being described here. That is cemented for us as fact, that in the fact of the phrasing there in verse 8 that says, if he has designated her for himself, right? That's what's going on here. The master has bought this woman from her father, intending to marry her or marry her off to his son. And so, yes, fathers are in fact selling their daughters in a sense into slavery, but they are doing that with the hopes of helping them sort of enter into high society via marrying up, right? This is what's going on here. And a father without the means to provide really the kind of life he wanted to for his daughter would sell his daughter to a wealthy man with the hope of three potential things we see in our text. First, maybe she would marry the master. Second, maybe she would marry one of the master's sons. And if not that, maybe she would marry into the family of another wealthy man that she met while serving in the master's house when she was granted her freedom. Now, again, while this is more innocent than we can conceive of, it certainly still had the potential to go sideways, right? So if the master wanted to break off the engagement, or if he decided after they got married he wanted to be divorced, it was a way more complicated situation than just send her home or divorce her. Because you see, once sold to a master, a woman did become his property. I know calling her property is uncomfortable to us, but since her father had sold her and the master had legally purchased her, she is the centerpiece of a transactional agreement between two consenting parties. And so it's just not as simple as send her home or divorce her. And so to ensure the welfare of these women, God enacts rules to protect against their exploitation. So we need to note this. A master was free to change his mind. He was free not to marry the woman. However, he was not free to do whatever he wanted to do with her. She may have technically and legally been his property, but she was a human being, not a pickup truck or a golf club, right? She was a daughter of God, not a disposable asset. If the master changed his mind about a female slave he had purchased for the sake of marriage, he had the following options. In verse 8, we see that he could let her family redeem her or buy her back from him. That's what it means when it says he's to allow her to be redeemed. But if the family was not able to afford or was unwilling to redeem her, in verse 8, we also see that he could not sell her to somebody else, especially a foreign people, right? He could not profit off of her. She may have been his property, but she was not there to be a source of profit. Further on down in verse 9, we see that if he had bought her for his son to marry and the son changed his mind about their engagement or nuptials, she was not to go back to being seen as a slave. She had been bought to be a daughter in the family, and she was to continue being treated as a member of the family. The father had sold her on the assumption that she would be treated as a daughter in this man's home. The spirit of that agreement was to continue, even if the man's son did not want to marry her. If they were married and then afterward he wanted to do the modern equivalent of divorce her, he was in fact free, sadly, to marry another woman, but he had to continue to provide for her needs. We see that in verse 10. You could call this the original alimony clause, with the exception that in addition to just meeting her basic needs, he had to continue to meet what we will call her bedroom or conjugal rights. That's what's meant in the text by marital rights. In other words, he had to continue to service her sexual needs, which I'm sure wreaked havoc on his new marriage, right? But good luck with that, buddy, right? But if he failed in any of these areas, this is important. If he failed in any of these areas, you know what she was? She was a free woman. She was free to leave his sorry behind and go marry another. And do not miss that that was no small thing in this Middle Eastern patriarchal era for a woman to have the right to do that, right? This is an incredible thing that God is providing for ladies. Now, as strange as this text sounds to our ears, it does not leave us without the gospel or ways to practically apply it. I pray that I have succinctly but clearly explained it well, illustrated it well, and now it's time to look for ways to apply it. So let me give you a point of practical application. And I may have missed a point there, Jacob, but I'm going to move on to next steps. So as the gospel transforms us, this is our first point of practical application. As the gospel transforms us, it should be transforming the world around us as well. Friends, we talked earlier about how we are really good at hearing and believing the gospel in church on Sundays and really terrible at seeing it put into practice every other day of the week in our lives. And I think that's because we lack a fundamental understanding of how the gospel was never meant to just be a mechanism of transformation for us individually, but rather a machine that changes the world around us, through us, for the better, as it conforms us more into the image of Jesus Christ. And there's a lot of concern. We are more reformed in our theological leanings here. And there's a lot of concern in more reformed church circles of speaking too much of social change by the power of gospel, because we fear becoming known as a church that is sort of drifting into theological liberalism and becoming social justice warriors. And while that concern has merit, and it does, it has merit. If we only ever speak of the gospel in terms of personal salvation, and never community transformation as well, we fail to embrace the truth that as God causes us to look more like Jesus, the inevitable byproduct of that will be that the world around us will start to look more like heaven. Right? So let's just look at the example of Jesus. Did Jesus just preach the gospel, or did he just perform more social good than anyone in history? Or did he do both? Right? Can anyone deny that Jesus Christ did more social good in a shorter time span than anybody in history? All right, I tell you what we'll do. I'll take Jesus. You go name everybody else. I like my odds. Can anyone also deny that Jesus Christ is the greatest preacher of the gospel that has ever lived? Okay, I'll take Jesus. You go get your Spurgeons, Edwards, and Matt Chandlers, and we'll see who wins. From Jesus' example, we see that we do not have to fear being socially conscious. We don't have to fear seeking to be God's agents, bringing God's transforming and redeeming power to bear on the world around us. We can preach and believe the gospel that says Jesus died to save sinners and be socially involved in seeking to alleviate the pains and the brokenness of the world around us on practical levels as well. We can do both. We must do both. How could the gospel grip us? How could the gospel grip us? How could it grab a hold of us individually and then not be changing the world around us through us as well? Or are we so obtuse as to believe that God cared for the plight of the poor and the powerless and the broken in the past and yet cares nothing about those people in our world today? My question to us as a church is very simple. Who are those who, like in our text, who due to horrific sin in their lives or maybe just a series of bad decisions, or maybe we should just embrace that some of us have been born on third base and we think we hit a triple and other people are having to grind their way into a single. Who are those people in the world around us who find themselves at the mercy of a system that seeks to rob them of their dignity, who seeks to become a crutch for them, to addict them to living on a welfare state for the rest of their lives? Let's find those people and let's punch back the darkness from around them. Did you know that in our city, there's not a single dedicated homeless shelter? Social workers in our city, if a person is homeless, they have to find a way to get the person to Tupelo or Tuscaloosa, an hour away. How's a homeless person supposed to get there? How are they supposed to get there? Did you know that there are very, very few opportunities for, in particular, women who are just coming out of being incarcerated or just getting out of drug rehab? There are almost no halfway house type opportunities for those ladies. You can measure the effectiveness of a church, but this question: if New Journey died today, would anybody even miss us? Would anybody even know that we weren't here anymore? As we end, forgive me for my passion. Or don't forgive me, because I probably don't need forgiving for it. I want to end by showing you the gospel in this passage. And I do believe that the easiest place to see sort of the shadow that the gospel cast on this passage is in the ceremony a servant would undergo if they wanted to stay with their master. We find this in verses 5 and 6. So I'll say it this way in a summary statement. It's a big thought, but that Jesus was pierced for us on the cross, showing he was fully submitted to the will of the Father. He now demands that we bear his marks on our body, showing that we have fully submitted to him. So when the time came for a slave to exit the house of his master, he could choose to stay if he wanted. If that was the case, the text here says that you must bring him before God. What that would involve is you would have to bring him down to the tabernacle, to the elders, And the slave would have to say, I want to stay in the home of my master. And then immediately following that, what they would do is some of the elders and a few close friends and family, I don't know who all would participate in this, they would go back to the home of the master, where the slave would lean up against a doorpost and have a hole punched in his ear with an awl, which would basically be a rudimentary ice pick, right? That's essentially what's happening here. This public confession reminds us of baptism, right? Going before the elders, going before God and publicly confessing, I love my master and I want to stay with him. It reminds us of baptism, where a new believer or a new follower of Jesus declares their allegiance and affections for him, stating that they want to stay with Jesus forever, that he is their Lord or master, if you will. And the purpose of this public ceremony was so that a master could not force a slave to stay in his house against his will. You see, if a slave had been in the house of a master longer than 6 years and had not participated in this public ceremony, everybody in town would know that the slave was being forced to stay there against their will. And so when the elders would give their blessing to the slave who wanted to stay, right, it was their way of acknowledging that decision. And so the purpose of the ear puncturing, so they would go and have the ear punctured, and this is twofold, really. The first thing it did is it marked the slave as belonging to the master. The slave could never deny the right of the master to them because they would now bear the mark of their master forever. It's almost like a piece of cattle that's been branded, right? It cannot say it doesn't belong to the man who has branded it because his brand is upon it. The second thing that the puncturing of the ear did was that it was symbolic because it, in being nailed or stapled to the doorpost of the master's home, what it represented is that that slave was now stuck to that home forever, literally for a few seconds, figuratively forever. And I don't know about you, but you can't hear the idea that someone is nailed to a doorpost, a piece of wood, and not think of Jesus nailed to the cross. Jesus submitted to the will of the Father. Jesus was fully God. He's the equal of God the Father in every respect, and yet he did what theologians call he subordinated himself to the will of the Father. And Isaiah 53:10 tells us what the will of the Father was. It was to crush him on the cross for the sake of wretched sinners like me. Now, why would Jesus, being fully and equally God, submit himself to that? For the very same reason a slave would choose to submit himself to the care and home of his master in the book of Exodus. A slave would only do that because they loved their master and because they were sure that their master loved them. Jesus submitted to the Father. He endured the cross because he loved the Father. But friends, he also did it because he was sure that the Father loved him with an eternal, incomprehensible love that flows only between the members of the triune Godhead. And it's likely that David has this future King David in the book of Psalms in chapter 40, verses 4 through 6, or excuse me, 6 through 8, it's likely that David is prophetically almost having a vision of this future subordination of Jesus when he writes these words. In sacrifice and offering you have not delighted, but you have given me, and this is how the ESV translates it, others translate it a little more clearly, you have given me an open ear. That's what it says. You have opened my ear. Burnt offering and sin you have not required. Then I said, behold, I have come. In the scroll of the book, it is written of me. This is how we know that he is futuristically pointing to Jesus, because there hadn't been no scroll written at that point pointing to David. Right? You get me? It's pointing to Jesus. In the scroll of the book, it's written of me. What is written of Jesus in that scroll? I delight to do your will. I delight to do your will. Oh my God, your law is within my heart. David is writing futuristically, and he has Jesus' submission to the Father and his delight to do the will of the Father in mind. In Exodus, if a slave wanted to submit themselves to the master, they would be nailed to the doorpost. Jesus submitted to the will of the Father, and he was nailed to the cross. In Exodus, a servant that submitted to their master would bear the marks of that decision forever, a hole in the ear. Jesus bore the holes in his hands, his feet, and his side forever, even after the resurrection, remember? Jesus' resurrected body still bore the marks of the cross upon it. And friends, if we belong to Jesus, we will bear the marks of Jesus on us as well. I can't help but think of what Paul writes in Galatians 6:17, where he writes that he bears the marks of Jesus upon his body. To be fair, Paul probably has a double meaning in mind. He probably in some respect means I bear the same sorts of scars and wounds from all the beatings that I have suffered for the sake of Jesus. But I think he also has in mind that a person who has been crucified with Jesus, see, this is the gospel. The gospel is not happy clappy. Here's the gospel of Jesus Christ. If you want to follow Jesus Christ, here's what he invites you into. Come be crucified with me so that you can be raised to new life in the same way that I have and become a new creation, right? And a person who has been crucified with Jesus Christ will bear the marks of that transformation upon their lives forever. The same way a person may have cosmetic surgery that makes them look completely different, but that surgery leaves behind scars that will never leave, right? A person who is bearing the marks of crucifixion and resurrection upon their body, those marks will stay with them forever. To bear your cross and crucify your flesh will, in the words of Chris Farley and Tommy Boy, leave a mark. A few of us have seen the movie and are saved. For the rest of you, I'll pray for your souls this week. So I'll close with just a couple of questions. Friends, do you bear the marks of Jesus Christ upon your body? Can you say that like Paul? That you've suffered for the glory of the name of Jesus Christ? If nothing else, that you have at least suffered the death of your sin nature and are suffering that daily? Do you bear the marks of Jesus upon your body? What in your life has been transformed by the presence and the power of Jesus Christ at work within you? Do not fool yourselves. Do not fool yourselves with false assurance. I don't care if you walked an aisle and said a prayer in the third grade. I want to know what marks of transformation are upon your body, because the presence and the power of Jesus Christ are at work within you, sanctifying you and changing you from the inside out. As human beings, as sinners, we will serve a master. See, as tough as this text is, here's the truth. We're going to serve a master. We were created to worship. We were created to serve, and that means we will serve a master. We'll either serve Jesus as Lord or Satan, our destroyer. You see, freedom, this is our mistake about freedom as Americans. Freedom is not about being able to do whatever my flesh wants to do. True freedom is being able to choose to do what our Creator has created us to do, which is to serve and worship Him. Today you must choose who you will serve. Today could be your Independence Day. It could be, friends, it could be your Independence Day. Today you are set free from your sin and your evil master. Today could be a day that you celebrate for the rest of eternity, because it is the day you were set free to serve Jesus Christ forever. And doesn't that statement sound oxymoronic? Set free to serve. But that's what it means to follow Jesus Christ. Today could be that day that you celebrate for the rest of eternity. It could be your Independence Day. And if you want it to be, friends, come see me in the back as we enter into our time of response. Pray with me as our band comes and prepares to lead us in that. Father, in the name